you're sure not tall, and you're not all that attractive, 'cause you're a level 8 dwarf, and you drink too much ale, you drink way too much ale. But you've got a nice axe, and you know how to use it. It's +2 against zombies. And the moment you step foot in this campaign, you set a magic missile on my heart, charm person on my brain. Dungeons and Dragons, yes, I like.
Welcome once again to the D&D Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Merles, and with me this week are Rodney Thompson.
Hello.
And Jeremy Crawford.
Hello, everyone.
This week, we're tackling a few different topics. As you remember from the last episode, we have a couple different segments, one of which is led by each of us. So sit back, relax, and here we go. Hey, so Mike Merles here, Group Manager, RPG R&D. You've obviously heard me on prior podcasts, but you may have noticed that you're now seeing a lot more of me on the website. We've launched a new series of weekly articles. I answer questions every Monday in the rule of three. There are three questions. Either I answer them or I find someone to answer them. And those are all questions that you guys send in. And I also write a column on Tuesdays called Legends of Lore that looks at the past of the game and sort of looks at how D&D has changed and uses that to inform, you know, how we're thinking about where the game could go in the future as far as things are 4th edition, why we're making some of the choices we're making in terms of design, and really how D&D has existed over the full almost 40 years of its existence, because it has changed a lot. Where we are is not necessarily where we could have been, depending on how things ended up in terms of design decisions or just what the audience wanted. There's also a column by Chris Perkins talking about DMing his campaign. And that's really meant to give a lot of DM advice and give insight into how Chris runs his campaign. I think he's one of the best DMs I've ever met. And we also have design and development columns that appear every Wednesday tackling the specific issues about a product, how we end up designing it, the choices behind it, and how it ended up that way. And really what we're trying to do with these columns is give a line of communication, create one between the audience, you guys listening out there, and everyone here in R&D. You know, when looking at the past couple years of how things have gone, I think in some ways it's very easy for us to lose track of what the audience is talking about, what's important to you guys, and what you want to hear from us and what you want to see from us in terms of product and in terms of thinking behind our design. So that's really what those columns are about. As an example, we have a new errata process, a new rules update process we've rolled out, and that was initiated 100% by messages, questions sent in for the rule of three. We'd had an errata process. It had been a bit delayed because we were working on updates for the classes from PH1 for the class compendium, and when we got those emails, we saw a number of emails about the rules update process, and it was obvious we needed to do something. So we have a new process, and we're working on it, and we're tackling issues because you guys asked for it. And that's really what these columns are all about.
Yeah, this is Bart Carroll, the editor-in-chief for the free side of the website, helping shepherd the content from the designers and developers onto the website. And just to reiterate that we are always looking in as many places as we can for the questions for the Rule of Three. The feedback threads in the forums are always very robust and useful. People write in quite frequently to the dndinsider@wizards.com email address and other places that we're trying to find questions on Facebook and just through the message boards and other avenues as well. So let me ask about your comm a little bit.
Sure.
Where do you see it going now that you've sort of broached the topic of what you're trying to do? Sort of pitched as taking a look at the past of Dungeons & Dragons, maybe some of the earliest design decisions and how they've kind of carried through the game. What topics do you see on the horizon that you're going to be interested in covering?
Well, really, it's a chance for me to talk about whatever topic comes to mind. I talk about adventures in the near future. I've also thought about the DM workload, monsters, campaign settings, how those have changed. There's a lot to write about with adventures, and I've just kind of, what I wrote takes one look at it from one angle, but I'm sure I'll go back and look at it from some different angles. And what I really want to get into is how the game has changed over the years, and has it changed because of the way it's been designed? Has it changed because that's the way people play? And really, what should D&D be what can it be, and who should be deciding that? There's a lot of issues there, and really the most payoff for it comes just from in looking at how people talk about the game and talk about the columns. I write them in the sense of what I believe, but what I believe is not necessarily what's correct, and it's not necessarily what we're going to do as an R&D department. It's really just my chance to have a bit of a soapbox and just kind of bounce ideas off people, see how things go. You know, we have the columns and the polls. There's nothing really scientific about it. Like, I've seen a few comments like, well, it must be the marketing department say right about this or that. And that's about as far from the truth as you can get. It is pure R&D. I mean, this is purely within R&D's purview. And it's also really just kind of what topics interest me. Because generally when I ask a poll question, I'm generally interested in hearing the answer. And a lot of the times I will try to make the poll in such a way that what I think of as the obvious answer is not necessarily the answer that's available in the poll. I remember a few years ago now when my wife and I, before we were married, we had to go to these like marriage counseling sessions with the pastor who's going to marry us. And one of the things we had to do was fill out this questionnaire. And each statement or question you'd rate from like 1 to 5, with 5 being totally agree and 1 being disagree. And he told us we weren't allowed to answer 3 to any of the questions, because he wanted to force us to take a little more of an extreme stance than we otherwise would. Because most people will fall in the middle. But then if you kind of push them, you find, well, really, while they'll say they fall in the middle, maybe they, when they kind of think about it, or if they have to pick a side, they'll pick one side or the other. Mm-hmm. So I'm kind of just trying to get people thinking about the game. And if I can get people to think more about D&D and why they play the way they do and what they like, I think that's just kind of the goal there. It's just to make people think more about the game and approach it from that more, well, why are we doing things the way we do? Are there other ways to look at or to appreciate, well, this is how the game used to be played, and maybe I was never exposed to it, so maybe I should check that out or think about playing the game that way. But it's not really in the sense of like, well, this is how you should play, because I think that doesn't make any sense in D&D. D&D is all about you play it the way you want to play it, not the way I try to make you play it. That's not going to end well for me as a professional, trying to force you into playing a certain way.
Yeah, just to go back a bit and to reiterate a little about what you said, for the reasons that we wanted to start the columns in the first place was to open up a bit more of that discourse between R&D, I think in particular, not just Wizards of the Coast, but Wizards of the Coast RPG R&D, and the community, the player community. You know, the website has always had robust content, but we wanted to find columns that met a criteria of being a little bit more regular and a little bit more communicative between us and the players. So a couple other things going on the website in coming days that I did want to ask about. What is the D&D championship?
So when we looked at the D&D championship is held at Gen Con, and it's essentially your chance to become the best D&D players in the world. It's a very competitive format. I believe you will make up your own characters based on certain parameters and will face a series of very difficult encounters. It's a lot like the D&D Open used to be. And the idea is if whoever defeats the encounters the quickest or gets the furthest wins, and they are the champions of D&D. And I believe there's 2 rounds. There's an initial round where if you complete the adventure in the allotted time span, you get to go on to the final. And then the final, it's whichever team performs the best. So it's really aimed at tactics, power gaming, and all that stuff. And teamwork, obviously. I believe last year, a couple hundred teams entered and only 8 made it to the second round.
Wow.
And I think of those 8, only 2 completed the adventure, or 1 did. It was very daunting.
Have you ever played in the D&D Open or the D&D Championship?
In 1999, in my first Gen Con, I and a friend entered the D&D Open. We were matched with a group, I think it was 8 players per group, so it was a group of 6 that needed 2. We made it all the way to the finals. And it was very cool, like, you know, just kind of the camaraderie that develops around the table. Back in the day, this was back before everyone carried a computer in their back pocket and their phone, there would be a bulletin board where they would post which teams had advanced to the next round. And I remember after the first round just being amazed we had made it. Like, it was so exciting because I had read about the D&D Open in Dragon and heard about, like, the Slaver series and how that was originally in the Open.
I was going to say, 1980, the 1980 championship became Area of the Slave Lords. And 1978 was Vault of the Drow.
So there's a lot of history there, and so it felt pretty cool. And actually, I wrote the D&D Open twice. I think my first 2 years here at Wizards, I wrote the D&D Open in those 2 years, or helped write it, and that was a lot of fun too.
So is it a sense of pride that no one can get through your adventure? Or do you root for the players that can get through your adventure when you wrote it?
I think, it's a good question. I think what I really wanted to do was if people defeated it, they felt challenged.
Mm-hmm.
They felt they had done something clever. I think that's really the key to it. You want to put something there where you think, okay, the players know what they're doing, they can get through this. And so you want to root for the guys who can, you want to kind of rooting for them to like figure it out, but only if they earn it. You don't want to like, I mean, anyone could just write an adventure where just everyone just dies, right? You have to find that middle ground between too difficult and too easy.
Thanks to everyone who participated in our D&D Championship Encounter Design Contest. All entries are being judged, and the winners will be announced on the website in the very near future. All winners will receive a copy of Heroes of Shadow and Shadowfell, Gloomrot, and Beyond. The D&D Championship takes place at Gen Con August 4th through the 7th in Indianapolis, Indiana.
Time for some mailbag questions. Before we dive into this podcast's game questions, just a reminder that if you have questions about Dungeons & Dragons, please send them to us at dndinsider@wizards.com. So, question number one, this I'm posing to you, Mike and Rodney, and this is from Doug. When updating monster damage and stat blocks, how do their base stats, such as strength and constitution, interact with their damage bonuses, their to-hit bonuses, and defenses? Or do those base stats not interact and only affect skills and initiative bonuses?
I think there's actually a short answer and a long answer to this one. The short answer is that they don't have to affect anything, right? Since the way that 4th edition monsters work is that there's sort of guideposts that your numbers are supposed to be at for those monsters. You can pretty much set them there and then set the ability scores at whatever you want. We assume that there are these floating bonuses and penalties in there that in previous editions you might have described as like feat bonuses or natural armor bonuses or things like that that compensate for ability scores in order to produce the numbers that we want. Now, the slightly longer answer is that if you go way back to the original DMG for 4th edition, there was some commentary about how monster ability scores could affect attack bonuses and defenses and things like that. And basically, I can't remember the exact wording of it, but for every 2 points of an ability score above or below baseline, you were supposed to adjust defenses or attack bonuses accordingly. Now, when we talk about monster design, obviously we don't typically do that because we want the numbers to hit the baseline. But if you want your monster's ability scores to match those numbers, you probably want to adjust those ability score numbers up or down accordingly, right? We typically say that higher level monsters just have better ability scores than lower level monsters. So you can nudge those up at the appropriate rate based on how many levels you've added to your monster.
I mean, the bottom line, and Mike, please jump in if you want, but the bottom line is that with a 4th edition monster, its level and its role have far more of an influence on its numbers than its ability scores do.
Right.
But Doug is exactly right that the ability scores feed into the skill bonuses, they feed into initiative, and also even in a monster where the ability scores aren't affecting any of the other numbers, they will often be reflected in the spread of the defenses.
Like right.
Typically, you know, Fortitude will be the highest defense of a monster whose, you know, strength con pair is better than its, you know, wisdom charisma pair or intelligence dexterity pair.
Yeah, typically we want to look at those ability score pairs for a little bit of verisimilitude in the defenses. For example, I remember when we were working on the Dark Sun creature catalog. When we looked at the defenses, we saw that they were often trending very close to one another, and so we went through and adjusted them up and down a little bit. And when we did that, Greg and I specifically looked at the ability score pairs to say, okay, this guy has, you know, charisma and wisdom in his lowest pair, so let's take his will defense down just one little bit, because that means that, okay, this guy's got a low charisma or wisdom, he should have a lower will defense regardless of what level or role even mean, say.
Right, right. All right, our next question. Question number two comes from Nick. Nick wonders just how free are free actions. Nick writes, this question keeps popping up in our game sessions, specifically the free action of the Dwarven Armor Daily Power.
Now, for those of you who don't know who are listening to the podcast, the Dwarven Armor Daily Power lets a character spend a free action and then regain hit points as if he or she had spent a healing surge. So getting back to Nick's email, he says, when the Dwarven Bard, Buster Rumplemintz, is hit by an attack, can he use the free action power of this armor between the attack roll and the damage roll of the successful attack? Basically, to regain hit points immediately before taking damage. What do you guys think?
I think that Buster Rumplemintz is the most awesome name for a dwarf ever. It's specifically included in the rules compendium that if your name is Buster Rumplemintz, you can take as many free actions as you want whenever you want. That's a lesser-known rule variation from the rules compendium.
I'll have to make sure to put that in in our next printing.
Put it in the FAQ at the very least.
That's
so
right.
People know.
That's right.
As for the question, Mike, do you have any strong feelings about free actions and frequency, or maybe even specifically the Dwarven Armor?
So I believe that free actions can't take place in between things like an attack roll and a damage roll because that's just like one action, isn't it? Like you've been attacked. Like I know for triggers, do we normally say like you've been hit by an attack?
Well,
no,
actually,
we will say that.
And that what you're getting at, Mike, is in this case, Mr. Rumplemintz could not use the power in between those two things because the power doesn't have a trigger. Basically, the only powers in the game that can mess around with timing are powers with triggers, and then those triggers basically tell you when you get to break a rule. The trigger would say you are hit by an attack, and then, bam, as a free action, you get to use this power. Because it doesn't say that, you have to use this as sort of a discrete action, not interrupting other actions.
So it can't take place during the middle of another action.
Exactly.
Now, that may be true, specifically for this action, because it's the dwarf using it between another character's phases of a single action. But how does that account for, like, the warden, for example, has his free action mark a bunch of guys around him, right? We've said in the past that if you are moving, that at any point in that move, you can use that free action to mark people around you at that point and then continue your move beyond that.
That is really a DM's call.
Right.
Because the default assumption of the system is that the warden has to do it before the move action or at the end of it, that actions don't divide each other up.
Sure. Sure. I guess the question is really, is the DM willing to let you interrupt your own action? Can I yell while moving? Because you know, free action is free action to speak and then moving, right? Do I have to say, hey, move 5 feet, come over here, right? Is it one of those kind of
things? No. Right. And as a DM, and in my campaign, I do have a warden, and I let him do exactly what you describe.
Right.
He can interrupt himself. It's just sort of by the rules, we're breaking the rules. But hey, this is what D&D is about.
So why is it that speech is a free action? Like, why did we have to give speech an action type? Can someone answer me that?
It's a way of telling you that by the rules, if you're stunned, and since, you know, when you're stunned, you can't take actions, it means you can't speak.
So we could have just said, stunned, you can't speak.
Right. That would have been another way of doing it.
I think we also, early on in the process, we didn't really have the concept of no action events, right? Like, it was actually probably around Monster Manual 2 before we really clarified the idea of the no action, right? A thing that happens that doesn't require an action to happen, right? Otherwise, up to that point, everything was sort of imagined to fit into an action bucket of some kind.
We did actually have some no action powers in Player's Handbook 1.
I'm not sure they were clarified.
It says no action in their in their action spot. But what wasn't clarified is how they were functioning in the action economy,
right.
And that's something that we got a clearer sense of as we worked on one book after another. But yeah, the no action has been there right from the start. The other thing, and this is something listeners that the three of us talked about before we started recording, if we were going to do this power now, it wouldn't even be a free action.
Right.
It would probably be a minor action.
Right. or a free action on your turn if we didn't if we want it to be something that wouldn't consume an action or something like that. Probably just be a little more specific, because early on I don't think we really understood the way free actions would act with the rest of the action economy, right? Yeah. And so we've sort of learned from that now and know we need either specific triggers or specific timing or, you know, things like that in order to make free actions work. Because really, the root of the free action is it's a thing we want you to be able to do without using up any of your very valuable action economy, right? Unfortunately, where immediate actions, which are part of your action economy, have very clear triggers, and then also reaction or interrupt, free actions didn't get that. So we have to be more, we have to be clearer with the triggers and clearer with the timing in those powers, just because it falls outside of this larger structure.
Yeah. Question three comes from Jaden. What happens to a character who starts one paragon path and then finds another that the player likes better? Is there a rule that covers the situation, or is that character forever stuck with the first choice?
I don't think there's an official rule under the retraining rules, but I don't think it's unreasonable for a DM to let a player swap that if you so if you choose to.
Right. The default assumption in the game is once you have a paragon path, or an epic destiny for that matter, you have it for the rest of your career. But it DMs everywhere, it will break nothing if you let your players change a paragon path or epic destiny. It might be an occasion for some interesting story developments in your campaign if suddenly the divine oracle cleric has, you know, turned her back on, you know, on the god of prophecy and has taken up some new paragon path. It could be a really interesting twist in the campaign.
Yeah, the whole retraining thing, actually, it sort of touches on an issue that has larger philosophical implications throughout the system, right? Retraining rules exist in 4th edition to sort of codify and legalize something that players and DMs have done since the dawn of D&D, right? I mean, we talk about Paragon Paths and Epic Destinies being locked in, but core class is the same way, right? And has been forever, right? If you were a first edition fighter, you were a fighter, right? Like the whole time. There weren't any codified retraining rules, but I feel like as, you know, over the history of the last 30 years of D&D, there's probably been one or two DMs that have been like, you know, I think you can let you rebuild your character towards something that you like better without any sort of formalized rule. So,
which Rodney, you did with one of your 4th edition characters.
Oh, yeah.
You basically retrained your class from wizard to Avenger.
That's right. And, you know, there were story implications that went along with it, but in the same campaign, Chris Youngs was playing a warlock, and when the Sorcerer came out with Player's Handbook 2, that just fit him better, right? And so even the story behind his character, it just fit him better. So Chris let him rebuild the character from the ground up as a sorcerer instead of as a warlock. It's just, you know, there's sort of a question of, does there need to be a hard and fast rule in place in order to let players do something with their DM's permission, right? The retraining rules, I don't want to say negate the need for DM permission, but they sort of put into stone something that has happened over many editions. I mean, even in 3rd edition and 2nd edition, I remember there were plenty of times where I was like, wow, I really thought this, I don't know, 2nd edition kit was going to be great for my character, and then it wasn't, right? And I was like, okay, I don't really want to play this character anymore, or my character has evolved over the course of the campaign. There weren't any real rules for that. It's just, we just sort of did it, right? And because, you know, there's no high stakes money on the line for me changing my character or anything. It doesn't really matter except in the sense of continuity that my DM and I have over the course of the campaign. So when it comes to things like Paragon Path, Epic Destiny, even though there's not a real rule, I really think that, you know, any DM and player combination can come up with a resolution for that relatively easily. All right, and now it's time for Good Gaming, the segment in the podcast where we talk about what we like about games this month, what we've been playing lately, what's exciting us about the gaming world. Gaming is good, but good gaming is better, and I want to talk a little bit about a recent trip that I took down to the lovely San Francisco area. I recently went to the Game Developers Conference, which is often abbreviated as GDC. GDC is a big convention in San Francisco where game developers and designers and publishers get together from across the gaming industry, mostly digital games, but also analog games as well, to share knowledge. It's very much a learning convention where you go to hear talks and seminars given by other gaming companies, by designers, by even the business people in charge of the business side of games to share knowledge amongst themselves. And so I basically spent 3 days in San Francisco listening to everything from postmortems on games that came out in the 1980s all the way up to, I went to a really great seminar by Richard Dansky that was about creating story in games and how in games, for example, there's a player element to telling a story that really affects the outcome of the story of the game, right? The story of the game isn't what the what the game tells the player, it's how the player interacts with it. So his seminar was all about crafting games that can tell a compelling story using that interactive element of the player, right? And that's just a couple of examples of the kind of seminars that I went to. But the reason I really wanted to talk about GDC this time was because it was a really exciting chance for me to go and listen to how other game designers are designing their games. And even though a large portion of what they were talking about dealt with digital games, right, console games and computer games, there was a lot to be learned. I mean, any of the talks I went to on story or narrative or character development in games applies just as well to D&D, and, you know, not just our, you know, what our players do, but also our adventures as well. Just as well as it does to the new Splinter Cell game or the new, you know, Grand Theft Auto or whatever like that. They struggle with the same kinds of problems that we do, trying to find ways to make their story compelling while also leaving enough room for players to make the story their own, right? I know we all have struggled with that idea that the adventure is a series of locations or characters or situations that we put out there, but we really can't predict how the story is going to develop because every gaming group interacts with the story of that adventure differently, right? I mean, my characters are going to do different things than your characters will.
Right.
And so a lot of the seminars really focused on that idea that interactive games of all kinds have a sort of give and take between what I'm telling you as the game designer, right, and what you're telling me or what you're telling in the story as you play through it. I just thought it was a really interesting series of seminars that I went to that showed that no matter what kind of game you're creating, many of the issues are the same across all systems.
I'm curious about the postmortems on the 1980s games. Like, what were some of the games they did postmortems on?
Let's see here. Populous was one that we talked about earlier today. Oh, I guess it was 90s, but mm-hmm. You know, an older game. There was one on Pac-Man. Mm-hmm. There were several that were old, like Pitfall was one of them, old Atari games, some early computer games. I believe one of the Ultima games got a postmortem as well. Basically, what they would do is they would have the designers and developers from, you know, 20, 30 years ago come back and say, okay, here's a game that's been out for a really long time. It was most of them were really big, successful games. I think only one of them was something I'd never heard of before. And they would say, here's how that process went, you know, 20, 30 years ago. Here's what we did right. Here's where we made mistakes. And it's a really educational experience because you can see something that has sort of become a known quantity, something that is a really, you know, core touchstone of the gaming community that everyone knows. And you can sort of sit here and listen, okay, here's how this thing came into being. I was just talking with Chris Youngs earlier, and one of the most interesting parts about these seminars is when they talk about either the mistakes they made or the problems they ran into, because it's always fascinating to see what were the problems back then, right? I mean, you know, 30 years ago, the problems were either really, really similar to the problems you would face now or completely different. Like, yeah, okay, we have dealt with that problem. That is an issue far into the past now, so they're always really fascinating, both as sort of a time capsule and as a learning experience, right? I really can't stress enough how great GDC was for learning mm-hmm. New things about game design, and it's just a fantastic culture there that the other designers, I mean, I said this when I first got back, but it was really fascinating that, you know, day one I go to this panel with a guy from LucasArts, and it's all about narrative and storytelling. And then on day two, I go to that Richard Dansky one that I was talking about earlier, and the guy that gave the panel on day one is sitting two rows down from me, you know, sitting there listening in that next panel, taking notes himself, right? The guy was there, everyone was there both to educate and to learn. And it was just a really refreshing, you know, experience that I went out there and got very energized, came back and said, okay, you know, there are people that take games seriously, and you know, here's what they taught me, and then, you know, maybe next year or in 2 years, I go down there and I teach them some of the things that we've learned in designing board games or RPGs or what have you. There's a seminar on what can modern games learn from TCGs, right? Mm-hmm. by a former Magic designer, right? There were seminars. I can't tell you the number of times that Dungeons and Dragons came up as an influence for games you wouldn't even think of, right? The Populous panel was one where they're like, yeah, so we got this idea because we all played a lot of D&D in high school, and so here's where that came from, right? So it was also fun to see how D&D was a touchstone for all of these designers designing games that are very far from D&D now, but yet still were part of those designers' formative experiences.
Yeah.
So that's what I've been enjoying about gaming lately, is just the sort of educational experience. What about you guys? What's been good in your gaming lives?
Well, I had the death plague for about a week and a half, and so during that time, I was on a BioWare RPG bender where I finished up Mass Effect 2 and then rolled straight from it into Dragon Age 2.
Wow.
And had a ball with both games. I mean, you're talking about, Rodney, you know, narrative and how player choice is such a key part of many games, particularly story-based games. And I would say both of those games do a fabulous job of integrating the player's choice into the construction of the story. And also talking about D&D's influences on games. I mean, it's always gratifying to play games where the influence of ye olde D&D is there on the screen. I mean, right, hour after hour.
Yeah, it's funny you mention, you know, the story and narrative in Dragon Age. One thing I heard a lot was the challenges that digital games designers face in telling a compelling story and giving lots of choices. For example, one of the talks I went to was all about cooperative gaming, and it was, how do you create these moments where cooperative gaming shines through, or where cooperative storytelling shines through? And I realized about halfway through the talk that all of the problems that he was bringing up and then the solutions he was offering were solved quantities for role-playing games. Like, these are not problems for us at all, because while they have to program things into, you know, a computer system and have to create an AI, we have the most sophisticated AI ever made, a human being right, sitting across the table from you to solve all these problems for you, right? And it was sort of nice that I could just sort of sit there and say, okay, we don't have to solve any of these programming problems. What we have to solve is the compelling experience, you know, problem, mm-hmm, right? What we can focus on is not how to make it work, but, you know, what's exciting and what's engaging, right? We could really zoom in on sort of the story and the narrative, and leave a lot of the technical side of it out, because we have humans to handle that for us.
Yeah. And I mean, instead, we have to focus on making that master AI very happy.
Right.
We rely on happy DMs.
Well, you know, just like you got to have an Xbox or a PS3 or a PC to play Dragon Age, you need to have a DM to play D&D, right? I mean, the role-playing game is a cooperative experience, and that big component of the DM needs to be kept happy.
Yes.
And, you know, we talk about adventures, for example, right? A player needs to be able to feel like he can set his own path in an adventure, but the DM also needs to be able to make the adventure his own. I mean, I don't know that anyone who's run a D&D adventure right out of the box doesn't put his own personal spin or her own personal spin on any adventure. I mean, it doesn't matter how old or simplistic the adventure. Every DM leaves their fingerprints on the play experience, and it really sort of reinforced the things that we heard about. The story is what happens when you actually play the game, and the DM is as much part of that story as the player.
Yes.
So, Mike, what about you? What have you been enjoying about gaming lately?
So I've been playing on the Wii I've downloaded some of the old NES games.
Oh, nice.
So I've been playing Punch-Out.
That is in my top three games of all time.
That's a fun game.
Yeah, I have the original Mike Tyson's Punch-Out.
Yeah, this one has like Mr. Miracle or the Dream Guy. Right, whatever. Right. When they colored him in orange after he ate that guy or
right,
he did.
Right.
And as it turns out, I don't have the reflexes I had when I was 12. I can't get, like, the second time you fight Piston Honda, I can't get, not that I've been trying a lot, but I can't beat the second Piston Honda fight.
Right.
So I'm going to have a look. But I beat Bald Bill for the first time I fought him. I just crushed him. It was fantastic. He did his little charge thing, and I just kept knocking him right over.
So you still had some of the old skills.
I had some a little bit, but for whatever reason, Piston Honda is a riddle that I've yet to solve.
Well, what's funny about those old NES games is that a lot of them were very pattern-based, right? Like, you figure out the pattern. I mean, Mega Man, Castlevania, whatever, right? These are all very pattern-based games, and I when I moved out here, I brought my still-functioning NES with me, and I have all my NES games out, and every now and then I'll pull a game out and stick it in and play it when I'm bored on a Saturday, and it's funny how quickly those patterns come right back to me, right?
Yep. Punch-Out is a lot more like, say, DDR or any other like rhythm game, like Elite Beat Agents or something, than an actual boxing game. Because you just learn, you know, dodge, 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 punch, 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 dodge, 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 punch, 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 whatever the, you know, the actual rhythm of what you have to get into.
Yeah. And, you know, there were a lot of those pattern-based games, right? I mentioned Mega Man and Castlevania, but then there was also, on the NES, you had the very first really big console RPGs, right? Like Dragon Warrior and Final Fantasy, which are just the complete opposite of that, right? There's no reflex or pattern-based stuff. It's all, you know, well, it's more like an RPG in that it's a little bit more deliberate, right?
Yeah.
So it's funny to see how starkly different those game types are, and yet both of them end up spawning lineages of games that still exist today, right? I mean, we're still playing Final Fantasy and Dragon Warrior games, but we're also still playing, you know, boxing games and things like that. So it's always interesting for me to look back at those sort of early origins of digital gaming and see what kind of creative new things respond back then.
Well, and games of all sorts are constantly cross-pollinating each
true,
other.
Very true.
Because, you know, like those pattern games, they've influenced even RPGs. Because it's funny, if you go into World of Warcraft and go into like a raid encounter,
sure,
so much of it really comes down to punch, punch, dodge, kick, kick, punch. It's just instead, you know, move out of the fire, use this spell, move over into the water. I mean, it's even the tabletop RPG,
right, where you get the really complex or, I mean, we've all designed a kind of gimmicky encounter every now and then, right, where it's like, okay, you got to go over here and turn the statues, otherwise the tidal wave will hit you just before the blue dragon breathes lightning on you, right? Well,
right.
You know, we've all designed that sort of puzzle encounter, right, that comes out of a lot of that. It's just obviously a lot slower developing than dodging Piston Honda or something like that, right?
Yeah,
yeah it's... Yeah. There's definitely an element of, well, I mean, it's probably just boils down to what the core of what games are, right? And a lot of what games are is either pattern recognition or pattern establishment.
Well, that wraps up another episode of the D&D podcast. As usual, send any comments, questions, or other concerns to dndinsider@wizards.com. And until next time, good gaming.
Thanks today to the Double Clicks, Portland, Oregon's comedy nerd folk sister band, for their song, This Fantasy World. You can find out more about the band at thedoubleclicks.com. Yes, I do. Yes, I like playing Dungeons and Dragons.